Welcome, everybody, to DB2 version 8. Are you done yet? My name is Diane McCollum, and I am the worldwide sales leader for IBM's DB2 for Z and DB2 and IMS tools. I will be your host today. I am pleased to introduce our speaker from IBM, John Campbell. John is a distinguished engineer in DB2 for Z development. John brings to this teleconference a wealth of DB2 information. Now I'd like to turn it over to John. John?
Thank you, Diane. I'd like to add my personal welcome to those people on the call today. What I'd like to do today is actually help you migrate as fast but also as safely as possible to version 8, and also, when you get to version 8, be able to exploit the impressive availability and performance improvements in that release. What I'd like to do now is to turn to slide 2, and let's go through the agenda today. First of all, I'd like to go through an introduction and basically talk about the strategic direction for DB2 for ZOS, and also talk at a very high level about the improvements in version 8 and also in version 9, which has also been announced. I'd then like to move on and address some of the myths about version 8, then move on and talk about the actual migration process to version 8 to help you migrate as quickly and as safely as possible. We're going to talk there about the secrets to a successful migration based on 3 years of customer experience, talk about a special technique called pre-migration catalog migration testing, and then talk about the highlights in terms of important points to consider in the planning process, and then drill down and talk about specific migration plan recommendations. In the final part of the presentation, I'll talk about the value proposition for DB2 for ZOS version 8, about how to improve performance and scalability, to prepare for and recover from logical data corruption, better management of very large databases, and application portability. Let's start now by turning to slide 3. In terms of the DB2 for ZOS strategic product direction, there are really 4 major themes. The first one is to continue to evolve as a secure enterprise data hub server. Basically, the centralized processing of massive quantities of data in a very secure way. We're striving towards DB2 family compatibility, with convergence between DB2 for LUW and DB2 for ZOS at the SQL and API level. One of the key points about our strategic direction is open APIs and core level interfaces, such as ODBC CLI, JDBC and SQLJ for Java, Unicode, Systems Oriented Architecture, Stored Procedure and for Java, and many other APIs. One of the other things we clearly want to achieve here is to continue to be the premier database technology in the industry, the gold standard for continuous availability with parallel sysplex and data sharing, allowing for incremental growth and also workload balancing and balanced performance across the range. The third part of our strategic direction here is about improved application enablement through extensive SQL functionality. What you've seen in the last couple of releases is significant investment from DB2 and the DB2 family in native XML support, and version 8 and later on version 9 continue that theme. We also have added object-oriented extensions to DB2 in recent releases, rules-driven integrity, and we've concentrated very much on porting major ERP and CRM package vendors to the DB2 for ZOS platform and having many successful custom implementations around the world. The fourth element of our strategic direction is continual performance improvement. This includes both price performance improvements, but also scalability. There's continual investment in optimizer technology in terms of both cost-driven rules and also heuristics. We try to improve performance across transaction, query, batch, and utility, trying to deliver balanced performance and high levels of concurrency. And we continue to focus on the utilities and tools area to have improved functionality and TCO improvements. What I'd now like to do is to move on to slide 4. Now, for this slide and the slides that follow it, I just want to really advertise really the highlights. This chart on slide 4 demonstrates that version 8 in terms of functionality is one of the biggest releases ever we've shipped in the history of DB2. The important point here is not to know everything about this chart. It's simply advertising the large amount of functionality we are delivering in version 8. If you now turn on to slide 5, this is exactly the same slide, except what I've done here is I've highlighted the features and functions in this new version 8 release, which actually are focused on TCO reduction in terms of either improving user productivity and also in terms of improving price performance. Now turn to slide 6. As you're all well aware now, we've announced DB2.9 for ZOS. This release is following on from version 8, and the only way to get through to version 9 is to migrate through version 8 first. What you can see again on this busy chart, slide 6, is you can see that version 9 is also packed with new features. And if we now turn to slide 7, again, the same chart has been highlighted to again show the items in the version 9 release which are related to improving TCO. And what you can see clearly again is that TCO reduction is a major theme of version 9. Now let's get into the main body of the presentation. Let's turn to slide 8. What I want to do very early in this presentation here is address some of the myths about version 8. These are things I've heard about and collected over the last couple of years. The first thing I want to stress is that version 8 is not a complete rewrite, re-engineering of the DB2 engine. What version 8 is very selective re-engineering of the DB2 engine to provide an architectural base for both version 8 functional enhancements and what we're delivering also in version 9. Examples of this selective re-engineering include rewriting and modifying the DBM1 address space to take advantage of 64-bit virtual addressing and to rewrite the parser function so we actually pass SQL statements in Unicode, and that gives us the ability to enhance the Unicode support that we first introduced back in version 7. Another thing that's very important to understand is that compatibility mode is not no new function mode. Version 8 is a single code base, and most of the code path is actually identical across the three modes of version 8, which are compatibility mode, enable new function mode, and new function mode. This assumes, of course, it's exactly the same applications. So it's a single code base, and almost all of the code path is identical across these three modes, unless you've actually modified the application. So in compatibility mode, you get a tremendous amount of new function, including, for example, 64-bit virtual addressing for the DBM1 address space, the rewrite of the SQL parser, so we're now parsing in Unicode, enhanced unity function, new access path selection, and many more enhancements. The only thing that's missing in compatibility mode is the ability to exploit the new SQL, DDL, and DML functions, which are available for the first time in new function mode. Basically, in compatibility, you get all the new function in DB2 version 8, apart from those functions which, if you were to use them, would prevent you from actually falling back to version 7 safely. So clearly DB2 version 8 is not two or even three releases in one. It's that single code base, most common code path, and what we're trying to do with these three new modes in version 8 is basically allow you to migrate safely and in a controlled way and to have a guaranteed method of fallback in the event of running into trouble in version 8 compatibility mode. We also need to address as well here, there's been some rumors and some discussion in the past about IBM not providing first-class support for compatibility mode and staying only in compatibility for a short period of time. These statements, by the way, need to be considered very carefully here. IBM does provide first-class support for compatibility mode. As I said, most of the new function is available in compatibility mode, and if you do run into some unforeseen problems and high-impact problems, either caused by defects in the product or by implementation and usage issues, you can at any point fall back safely from version 8 compatibility mode back to version 7 safely and quickly. You can stay in compatibility mode as long as you like. In fact, we strongly recommend that you run in compatibility mode for at least one application processing cycle. This may typically be a month or maybe even a quarter. And the idea is that by running in compatibility mode for one application processing cycle, this is proving the new release and exercising the new function and basically eliminating the possibility or driving down to near zero the possibility of having to fall back to the previous release through either some defect issues in DB2 or some implementation or user setup problems. Another thing I've heard on several occasions is that customers thinking they have to convert all their application data to Unicode. This is simply not true. What we are doing in version 8, by converting the catalog itself to Unicode and the rewrite of the SQL parser, we're trying to enhance the Unicode support that we first introduced in DB2 version 7. Customers who have their existing data in ASCII or in EBCDIC can continue to leave their application data in those code pages. There's absolutely no need to convert over to Unicode. As part of the version 8 announcement, we announced that there was no longer a need for an external sort package for DB2 version 8. That's because DB2 will now use DF sort exclusively within the DB2 utility suite. We're making this change for reasons of enhanced service and serviceability. And basically, there are no cost implications or license implications here. DB2 will be using a special license API and by the DB2 version 8 utility suite to exploit DF sort. Something we've heard over many years is that a large number of secondary extents are bad. We need to be very careful about this. A large number of secondary extents are bad when you run out of them, and that's an availability statement. But basically, a large number of secondary extents are not bad for performance, depending on the size of the extent. The size of the extent is more important than the number of extents from a performance viewpoint. And provided you're using cylinder allocation, then basically a large number of secondary extents is not a bad thing for performance. Most of you are on the call today, and most customers in general, are obviously very concerned from a TCO perspective about resource consumption. Not just CPU, but also virtual and real storage. We have many challenges on this release to try to limit CPU regression in version 8 for our customers. And this, of course, assumes zero exploitation of new application and configuration functions. We try to limit where we can the CPU regression to 5 to 10%. But this is not a typical increase in CPU resource consumption. Many customers in my social circle have had near equivalent performance in version 8 relative to version 7 without exploiting any new function, and many customers have seen actually performance improvements in migrating from version 7 to version 8. There are many tuning options available in version 8 to mitigate CPU regression as well. And once you've actually settled and running smoothly in version 8, there are many opportunities here for performance and scalability improvements. The bottom line here is there's no need to fear migration to DB2 version 8 with proper planning and testing and following a step-by-step approach followed by many other successful customers at this time. Now let's turn to slide 9. What I've got on the next few charts here are the secrets to successful migration. Firstly, the most important thing is to spend time and effort in testing prior to production to keep fires away from production. Any problem that can be found in development with the DB2 product, the installation or setup, avoid having to find that problem later on in production. So it's a wise investment of time to do some degree of regression testing in your own unique environment. In many customer situations, we've identified situations where the actual code page, the CCS ID used by the customers, is not correct, either because objects are tagged incorrectly, because the CCS ID in DSN HDECP was set correctly at one point in time, or in fact multiple EBCDIC CCS IDs. So it's very important to identify very early on whether there are any code page issues, and you can help identify this by running the job DSN TIJP8, which is originally available in version 8 itself, but then taken back to version 7. And when you run this job against the DB2 catalog, it tries to identify all the incompatible changes between version 7 and version 8. And it will enable you to identify whether you've got more than one non-zero EBCDIC CCS ID in your DB2 catalog. Once you've actually found a problem, the best thing to do is to open an ETR or PMR with DB2 development and to ask for expert advice on how to clean up the situation. So it's much better to identify the problem in version 7, analyze all the inputs and outputs, and systematically test to avoid data corruption. It's much easier to do this in version 7, because if you do it to version 8, in version 8, it's unlikely to be any easier, and in fact, cleaning up such situations would be much more difficult in version 8. The third item on this chart is called pre-migration catalog migration testing on a clone image. This is something I'd like to strongly recommend. This is the idea of taking a clone copy of the catalog and directory objects away to a cloned system, an auxiliary DB2 system, and basically cold starting that system and then actually practicing the migration process to make sure you're familiar with it, to know exactly how long it's going to take, to avoid JCL and out-of-space conditions, and basically determine the elapsed time for the process. And in a minute, I'll go into some more detail about this. One of the unique things about the DB2 for ZOS database engine is that we've always supported release fallback toleration. In this case, the ability to migrate to version 8, if unforeseen problems arise, to be able to fall back to version 7 and to continue processing, and to be able to do this very quickly, and then to re-migrate forward again, and to be able to do this safely. And so one of the things you ought to do as part of any version 8 migration plan is to perform systematic testing of release fallback toleration. Those customers who have been very successful in migrating to version 8, many of them have had batch regression testing suites, which they've run repeatedly in their environment to check their maintenance level and to also study performance and resource consumption. On the subject of resource consumption, it's very important prior to version 8 to have a performance baseline so you can monitor CPU, virtual, and real storage usage both prior, during, and after the V8 migration. And IBM tools such as RMF, DB2 Performance Expert, or the new merged DB2PE, PM, and OmegaMon tools are excellent for building a performance baseline and monitoring your system. Let's now turn on to slide 10 and discuss some other secrets to migration. Many of you out there are data sharing customers, and many of you would like to support release coexistence, both version 7 and version 8, in the same data sharing group for a period of time because continuous availability is actually key in your environment. DB2 version 8 continues the trend of providing first-class coexistence support. We're able to roll in, member by member, the new release. The advice, as before, is to keep the period reasonably short. And by that I mean a few minutes to a small number of weeks, like 4 weeks. And although we provide first-class support for release coexistence, and we test it very thoroughly, experience tells us that when customers stay in coexistence for a very long period, the chances are they'll find a problem that's unique to coexistence and not related at all to the actual new release. We've also provided a new option on the AutoBind ZPalm in version 8 called Coexist. And the advantage of this is that when you're running in version 7 and version 8 coexistence, there are some operational requirements which are documented in the data sharing planning guide. And one of those things is to carefully manage from an operational perspective actually application bind jobs. And a strong recommendation is to run those jobs in version 7. However, in some cases, plans and packages will be invalidated when migrating to version 8, and it's possible that these will be go through auto-rebind on the version 8 release. What the A-bind option coexist tries to do is try to avoid the repetitive ping-pong between plans and packages being rebound on version 8, then being executed on version 7 and being invalidated again, and going through a rebind, and going through this process repetitively. So what A-bind coexist tries to do is just have one ping and a pong and to avoid this repetitive invalidation and automatic optimization. As I said earlier in this presentation, one of the most important recommendations in this whole presentation is to run for a complete application processing cycle in DB2 version 8 compatibility mode to prove the new release in your environment and to reduce as much as possible down to zero the possibility of having issues once you submit the enable new function mode job. For many customers, this will be a complete monthly cycle, and in some cases, this may be a quarterly cycle. The next stage after version 8 compatibility mode is version 8 enable new function mode. This is a very important step. This is the step which involves a series of online reorgs share level reference where the catalog objects are converted, first of all, to Unicode. Many character columns are converted from char8 to varchar128. And some of the catalog objects are converted to 8 and 16K page sizes. Many customers will actually schedule an outage for this. It's not absolutely necessary, but many customers will schedule an outage for this because what we want to do is to get that enable new function mode job through as fast as possible and avoid any possibility of interruption with online transactions and batch traffic. One thing that we've run into in several customers is problems with DB2 Connect. Version 8, release 1, Fix Pack 5 is the absolute minimum level for DB2 version 8 as documented in the announcement letter. Based on my field experience over the past 3 years, I would strongly recommend that version 8 release 1 Fix Pack 10 and the equivalent of version 8 release 2 is Fix Pack 3. This should be your minimum level in migrating to version 8. The reason for this is that I know between Fix Pack 5 and Fix Pack 10 there's a whole sequence of fixes for issues related to performance, coexistence, and connection concentration. And you should also recognize that Fix Pack 5 is now some 2.5 years old. Another important point in migrating to any version of DB2, and also in normal operation, is to have a sound maintenance strategy. When building your initial code base for version 8, I strongly recommend that you take advantage of the consolidated server test process and the quarterly RSU tape, which is generated from that process. That testing is testing performed in addition to the testing performed for DB2 development, and it also includes the latest maintenance from other products on the DB2 for ZOS and ZOS platforms. And thereafter, to take advantage of enhanced hole data to get informed about the latest hypers and PEs for DB2. Any plans that exist in your DB2 catalog that have not been rebound since DB2 version 2 release 3 will be invalidated and go through a rebind process. I'd like to remind you that in a data sharing environment, this rebind activity will be single threaded. One thing that greatly helps during the life of version 8 will be to rebind all plans and packages, especially those associated with high volume and performance sensitive applications. General recommendation first of all, as in the life of any given release, like version 8, is to rebind all the plans and packages to take advantage of optimizer enhancements and to move forward the concurrency point for all your plans and packages. Secondly, to do this on an incremental manner, starting with the fact that once you're actually running stable in version 8 compatibility mode, it would be a good idea to target the high volume and performance sensitive applications and to rebind those as a way of mitigating possible CPU regression in version 8 compatibility mode. One thing that can greatly improve the performance of the Enable New Function Mode process is to reorganize catalog and directory objects no later than version 8 compatibility mode, and in many cases just prior to migrating to version 8. Some of you I know do not reorganize catalog and directory objects very often, and some of you may never have done it. So one thing I would recommend is that prior to going to version 8 compatibility mode, sometime leading up to that, is to reorganize all catalog and directory objects that are allowed to be reorganized. One of the pieces of new function that you actually get in version 8 compatibility mode for the first time is the ability to reorganize catalog and directory objects that have hash links. This is the opportunity to do this for the very first time. So again, in version 8 compatibility mode, before you submit the job to go to enable new function mode, it's a good idea to reorganize those catalog and directory objects. Let's now turn to slide 11. This slide is about pre-migration catalog migration testing. This is something I've seen in many customer cases that's proved to be extremely useful. This is the idea of cloning the production catalog and directory and practicing migration on this clone copy in an auxiliary DB2 subsystem without risk, be able to practice it, understand the steps, and be able to prove this in a test environment before going to production. Options for actually taking the backup include concurrent copy, flash copy, taking a DFSMS dump, and the install job DSNTIJIC. As I said, this gives you the ability to practice the migration, first of all the cat maint, and then the enable new function mode job. And you also have the ability as well to rebind all the plans and packages, explain all the views, and check that you're actually getting good access paths, and detect any rogue ones. You can also build on this as well and extend it, so you actually clone some of the application data as well, and therefore you can extend this test environment to an extended regression test, and also engage other parties, application developers and DBAs, in the migration and pre-migration process. We now turn to slide 12, pre-migration catalog migration testing. This is a specific example which I'd like to show you. This applies to a data sharing customer who's decided to use concurrent copy in version 7, where he uses version 7 concurrent image copy of the catalog and directory. He then basically goes through a process, which is very similar to the initial install of a DB2, or a DR process, where he deletes the existing data sharing group, deletes the data sets, forces away the coupling facility structures, then goes through the process of setting up a new DB2 data sharing group, defining brand new clusters for the bootstraps, the logs, the work database, the temporary database, then restores the image copy using DFDSS, and then performs a cold start of DB2 and DB2B in this example, two members in the data sharing group in maintenance mode, rebuilds the missing directory indexes, defines the local buffer pools, then actually delete defines the work file and temporary databases, and finally then runs through the migration process. There's some effort definitely up front to do this for the very first subsystem or data sharing group. But once you've done it for the first, say, group, which might be a systems program or test bed, You can repeat this process again and again and do it very cheaply for each of your DB2 environments from test all the way through to production. Let's now turn to slide 13. What I now want to do very quickly is go through some very important quick hits and get them out of the way. Earlier I mentioned that DF Sort is an absolute prerequisite for the version 8 utility suites. So if you're running a sort package and your primary sort package is something other than DF Sort, you will actually have to make the DF Sort utility, which is part of the standard ZOS install, available to the DB2 utility suite through linked list or step line. As I said earlier, there is no financial penalties here or license obligations. DF Sort is part of the standard ZOS install, and all that's happening is the version 8 utility suite is actually using a special license API to unlock and use very specific functions of DF Sort. ZOS 1.5 is the recommended version of ZOS for best performance. And APAR II 14047, which is very extensive, is mandatory reading for anybody who is not already using DF Sort as their primary sort package. Next topic here is console security in SysOpera. Basically, commands coming through the console no longer come through with an auth ID of SysOpera. One example of that is TSO SDSF users, where each TSO SDSF user comes through to DB2 with an auth ID of SysOpera. This will no longer be the case in version 8. The real auth ID of the user will come through. Furthermore, if you're a customer who has one of the installed SysOperas in the ZPalm set to SysOpera, any user who previously was able to benefit from this will now come through with his real auth ID and will no longer actually get installed SysOpera ID. So one of the things we've done to greatly help the migration process and welcomed by many customers is that we now support RACF groups and secondary auth IDs for command authorities. So basically you can create a RACF secondary group, assign either SysOpera or install SysOpera authority to that RACF secondary group, and then assign the individual users or connect them to that particular group. Let's now turn to slide 14. As I said earlier, in version 8, the DB2 catalog will be converted to Unicode. I want to stress that even when you're in version 8 compatibility mode, the first time you start DB2 in version 8, DB2 from that moment onwards will be operating internally in Unicode. All SQL parsing of dynamic SQL and SQL at bind time will all be in Unicode, and the derived metadata will be in Unicode. But actually, when you get to the Enable New Function Mode job, this is a series of online reorgs where that's the time at which the catalog will physically get converted to Unicode and will cut back on actually code page conversion between EBCDIC and Unicode. In fact, we actually turn off code path. So, strong recommendation to use DSN TIJP8 under version 7 to identify whether you've got the wrong CCS ID or you've got multiple CCS IDs within one encoding scheme. One thing you must do prior to version 8 is to install and configure Unicode conversion services. As soon as you start any mode of version 8, DB2 will do a check for non-zero valid CCS IDs and will do round-trip conversion between EBCDIC and Unicode to make sure that all the right code pages are in place. You cannot run with the default Unicode conversion services image. The Unicode conversion services image will have to be customized for your unique environment. As a bare minimum, as described in this chart, you'll first of all have to have conversions to and from the three Unicode CCS IDs and your normal ASCII or EBCDIC CCS ID. You'll also have to have a round-trip conversion between your client CCS IDs on Linux, Unix, and Windows, and again, those three Unicode CCS IDs. You also have to add to and from conversions between the special CCS IDs used by DB2, specifically CCS ID 37, for DVRMs provided with the DB2 install, CCS ID 500 for DRDA, and CCS ID 1047 for Unix System Services. The very first time you use Unicode conversion services, this will require an IPL. So it's best to take advantage of a scheduled outage at some point prior to the version 8 migration to include that IPL in that outage. But having enabled Unicode conversion services for the very first time, the Unicode conversion image can be changed at any point in time, and that new image can be picked up by DB2 on the fly without having to recycle DB2. For very best performance with Unicode conversion services, IBM System Z, Z890, Z990 or later, and ZOS Release 4 are recommended for best performance. Continuing on the theme of quick hits, please turn to slide 15. One of the important things about version 8 is that the version 8 precompiler will generate modified COBOL source that will not go through the old COBOL compilers. Specifically here, I'm talking about OS VS COBOL, which has been out of support roughly since 1994, and VS COBOL 2 that went out of support in 2001. Any of these old COBOL load modules will continue to work with DB2 version 8. It's recommended that you relink them to run in an LE environment from the viewpoint of serviceability. So as a minimum recommendation, it would be a good idea to relink these old COBOL load modules so they can run in this LE environment for serviceability. However, if you modify one of these COBOL programs and run it through the version 8 precompiler, then basically that modified COBOL source will not go through these old levels of the compiler. So basically, the real thing to do is to get a migration plan in place, either in the lifetime of version 8 or very shortly after, to Enterprise COBOL version 3.2, or a later version that supports the version 8 precompiler. Many people will continue to run the version 7 precompiler for a period of time with the old COBOL source programs to avoid having to do a mass migration to the new Enterprise COBOL. Many people as well, after the normal 12-month overlap period with version 7 and version 8, will pay a small fee for version 7 just to use the version 7 precompiler going out for a year or two into the future. I'd also like to stress that you ought to review your dump and standalone dump procedures. Many of you have actually opened problems in the past on earlier versions of DB2 where partial dumps have been delivered to development to support an open ETR or PMR. And partial dumps are always very disappointing because it's always the fact that partial dumps, the bit that's missing is the point you need in order to actually service the problem. So people should actually review their max space settings prior to and during version 8 migration to make sure the max space setting is large enough so that we can capture the full size of the dump. It's also important to allow enough real storage and paging space so we can actually capture those dumps efficiently and without causing significant disturbance to the existing workloads. Taking advantage of DFSMS striping for the dumps greater than one volume is also important for performance when capturing the dump, and using dump groups so that many dump volumes can be written concurrently. Now let's turn to slide 16. And finally, some other things I'd like to complete here. I'd also like to point out that many of the defaults for the Z-Palms have changed. Some of them have changed to be more intelligent, and some of the defaults have changed because some of those storage areas actually moved above the bar in version 8, and therefore we can afford to allow it, enlarge them now, provided we have the real storage to back them. As customers, you still have a choice in version 8 between PDS and PDSE. However, in version 9, there will actually be no choice. You will have to use a PDSE for SDSN load. Most customers in my social circle have decided to stay with PDSs for the time frame of version 8. Bimodal migration accommodation is definitely not supported. What this means in very plain English is that you can't start version 8 in a 31-bit environment, whether it be a 31-bit operating system or a 31-bit hardware configuration. For those of you who are using encryption and the IBM tool for IMS and DB2 for encryption, it's very important to put the module SCSF Mod 0 in the link list. This is clearly advertised in the install guide, but I've noticed that several customers have actually forgotten to do this. And if you have failed to do this, you will get some nasty messages coming out on the console. I also reference an important ISPF APAR here, which has been available for some time now. And this APAR introduces a new Unicode command. And this enables you to browse Unicode data through your TSO session. Many of you, if not all of you, are using data management tools, either from IBM or other vendors. It's very important to check in with your vendor to make sure your vendor supports version 8. First of all, in toleration, but also in terms of exploiting the new features. For the IBM data management tools, there's a web page reference on this slide here which you should follow, which will tell you which versions and releases of the IBM data management tools provide toleration and exploitation support for version 8. In many cases, people have reported performance problems after having migrated to version 8. Basically, we both have a shared responsibility, both IBM service and you as the customer, to collect the right documentation to shoot these problems. I strongly recommend, as I said earlier, to create a performance baseline, to collect SMF data and reports from your performance monitor. You need both the accounting trace and the statistics trace, both to compare version 7 versus version 8, and explain ideally of key packages. So we need to understand the resource utilization both before and after the migration. And it's wise to have a prepared standard job stream that actually collects this data and the associated reports. Let's turn now to slide 17. What I'd like to do here now is move on and share my thoughts here about the actual migration plan to version 8. To repeat yet again one of my strongest recommendations in this presentation, it's to run version 8 in compatibility mode for at least one monthly cycle. That's a monthly application processing cycle. Sometimes this will be a month, and often that will be the case. Sometimes it will be a quarter. And the idea is to flush out any serious implementation, performance, or stress-related conditions before submitting the version 8 Enable New Function Mode job. Once you submit the version 8 Enable New Function Mode job, there is no possibility of falling back to either version 8 compatibility mode or to version 7. I now would like to share with you some observations across the superset of customers. First of all, most customers do not have a full-scale operational proving environment. In fact, some customers don't have any environment like this at all. Of course, if you had a full-scale operational proving environment and an application regression workloads, this would be ideal for flushing out regression and basically implementation issues. One thing from most customer viewpoints is you don't really want to run for an extended period with different code and function levels in the test and production environments. Specifically, when you get application quick fixes coming through, you don't want to have an extended window of opportunity where changes or application workload will work successfully in test, but then fail after migration to production. Regardless of the three modes of version 8, it's always been very important to have a clear separation between the exploitation and toleration of new features in any given DB2 release. Basically, you don't want to exploit any significant new function which would inhibit fallback until you've actually proven the new release to be running stable in your environment for an extended period and where there's little or no significant problems. After having run smoothly on the new release and having migrated specifically in version 8 to new function mode, then you actually want to start exploiting the new function. One thing I want to stress here is to distinguish carefully between the words coexistence and compatibility mode. They both begin with the letter C, but the recommendations are very different. In terms of data sharing coexistence, the recommendation is to keep the period reasonably short, from a few minutes to a small number of weeks. In terms of compatibility mode, I want you to run in there for at least an application processing cycle, either a month or in some cases maybe a quarter. Now let's turn to slide 18. On slide 18, this is basically my recommended, or if you like, my framework for a version 8 migration plan. This example assumes a data sharing customer. The first principle is to practice in test exactly the same thing that you're going to do in production. So if you're a data sharing customer and you want to exploit coexistence, the recommendation is to migrate the first two members of your data sharing group to version 8, then wait a little while, and then roll version 8 into the remaining members. After that, you want to stop your version 8 migration test and run for an extended period in version 8 compatibility mode to demonstrate the stability of version 8 in your environment. What you then want to do is to move on to production. And in production, you want to go through exactly the same process, migrate the first two members, then in the next step, roll out version 8 to the remaining members, and then run for an application processing cycle in production. Once things are then running and demonstrated proven stability in production, the next thing to do is to go back to the test environment and then complete the enable new function mode and the new function mode jobs to get the complete test system into new function mode. And then the final step, to do exactly the same thing in production. I should point out that some customers have done things slightly different. And one of the most common differences, basically, is to hold back running the job which takes you into new function mode. Many customers will run the new function mode job, not the enable new function mode, but the new function mode job. They will run it in production first, and then actually run it in test. And this is to avoid any window of an application being able to slip in a change, which is be able to exploit new SQL, DDL, and DML function when version 8 in production is still not in new function mode. Let's now turn to slide 19. One of the hottest topics in any new release, and specifically in version 8, is resource consumption. And what I'd like to do here is deal with some of the myths and basically talk about reality in terms of resource consumption in version 8, what you can expect, and things that you can do to actually meet performance regression. There was a dramatic amount of new function delivered in version 8. Our target was to limit CPU regression to between 5 and 10% on average in a typical and customer environment, and this assumes zero exploitation of new functions in version 8 in your applications or in your system environment. And this will be the initial case for all customers migrating to version 8. Clearly, there are performance opportunities in version 8 which could clearly generate significant performance improvements. Later on, we'll talk about these in the second half of this presentation. However, let's now turn to slide 20 and talk about, in more detail, expectations on CPU performance in version 8. What every customer should be doing is basically thinking about what they can do, what actions they can take, even use the words weapons here, as a way of limiting performance regression. And what I have on this chart here, on chart 20 here, is a list of functions that can be turned on without changing any applications as a way of mitigating CPU regression. The first one is long-term page fix for buffer pool. Again, this is a new function that's available immediately in compatibility mode, where you can avoid repetitive page fix and page free on IOs to DASD and IOs to the coupling facility. One can turn on long-term page fix on an individual buffer pool level. Many customers have turned on long-term page fix for all buffer pools, but if you're concerned or conservative, you should target long-term page fix on those buffer pools which are IO intensive. It's not based on get pages here, it's based on IO intensity. And basically the CPU benefit of long-term page fix is directly proportional to the amount of I.O. to disk and also to the coupling facility. And one can actually come up with a relative measure here for each buffer pool by summing up all the buffer pool reads and writes and dividing by the VP size. And basically those buffer pools with the highest relative value are the buffer pools to target first. Secondly, many are actually collecting SMF89 records, including detailed CPU recording. You've been doing this because you've either been on a measured usage license plan or on a sub-capacity license plan. Basically, SMF89 collection is required for two purposes. First of all, product identification, and secondly, detailed CPU recording. The collection of SMF89 is turned on by the SMF Palmline member. Prior to version 8, you use the type or the no-type specification in the SMF Palmline member as a way of turning on SMF89. There was no granularity here. Basically, when you turned SMF89 on, you cut the SMF89 record for product identification, and you also turned on detailed CPU recording, which actually snapped the CPU cost either side of an entry and exit to DB2. Now, if a customer's not collecting SMF89 here, there is no benefit. However, if you're a customer who's on sub-capacity licensing scheme, and therefore you have to collect SMF89 for product identification, you have a new option in version 8 to set a new ZPALM called SMF89 equal to no. What this does is it still collects the SMF89 for product identification with negligible overhead, near zero overhead, but by setting SMF89 to no, you turn off the expensive detail recording. Now these first two items of long-term page fix and turning off SMF89 detail recording can generate significant benefits. Long-term page fix can generate, in my experience, up to about 8% CPU reduction. The overhead or benefit of turning off SMF89 detail recording is very variable depending on how many concurrent threads are running and how simple the SQL statement. But again, I've seen benefits here of between 5 and 8% by turning off SMF89 detail recording, and in some cases, even greater benefit. A recent APAR, PK28561, actually reduces package accounting overhead. One of the new functions in version 8 was extended package level accounting, but this actually generates extra overhead in terms of CPU costing and also increased SMF data volume. So we've actually introduced PK28561 to basically isolate whether a customer wants to use the new extended package level accounting. This will introduce a newer accounting class, accounting class 10, and it's only if you explicitly ask for accounting class 10 that you'll get the new extended package level accounting. When you get to version 8 compatibility mode, you get DBM 164-bit virtual storage support, and this may generate significant virtual storage constraint relief. If you're a customer on version 7 who was virtual storage constrained and now migrate to version 8 compatibility mode and get generous virtual storage constraint relief, consider setting the existing ZPalms, constore and minstore from yes to no to save the CPU overhead of these functions. In version 8 compatibility mode, if you're a significant DRDA user and making big use of DRDA block fetch, you can benefit significantly from automatic implicit multi-row fetch between the DDF and DBM1 address spaces. It is strongly recommended in the total life of version 8 to rebind all plans and packages for performance reasons and to move forward the currency point of your plans and packages. The potential benefits here are new access paths to reinstate fast column processing, otherwise known as SPROC, and to avoid the puffing overhead which occurs in any DB2 release boundary when we read the old structures like version 7 structures and puff them up to look like V8. It is strongly recommended here that you do not do a mass rebind in one go. The idea is to proceed in slow, incremental steps, even starting in compatibility mode, and to target initially the high volume and performance sensitive packages and plans. For data sharing customers specifically, there are two opportunities. First of all, in compatibility mode, and later on in new function mode. If you're a data sharing customer that's running on ZOS release 4 or later, and your CF level is 12 or later, then after you've eliminated the last version 7 member, migrated all the members to version 8, it's a good idea to manually trigger the rebuild of each and every group buffer pool, and that will enable these group buffer pools to benefit from the new CF batching commands. And this will particularly benefit high-volume, update-intensive batch processes. The next opportunity is actually in new function mode. The first time you get to new function mode, if you can quiesce the data sharing group, in other words, shut down all new members and grow through a group restart, this will switch to locking protocol 2. You can identify whether you're in locking protocol 2 by using the display group command, which will clearly identify which locking protocol is being used. Several customers in my social circle have benefited significantly from this new change. One customer has reported up to a 14% reduction in CPU, and another customer reported up to a 10% reduction in CPU in switching to locking protocol 2. So those data sharing customers who make extensive use of the bind option release commit, and where the major cause of faults in XCS contention is related to parent L locks, may benefit significantly from the first group restart after entry to new function mode. Let's now turn to slide 21. What you have on slide 21 here is a list of version 7 workloads and features which are likely to benefit from version 8 and suffer less CPU regression. So basically, the more ticks you have in terms of using all of these options on this slide, you are likely to get less regression on version 8 and may actually get significant performance improvements. One example of this would be data space buffer pool or hyper pool. When you originally went to hyper pool or data space buffer pool, you actually incurred a CPU hit of up to 10%. When you migrate to version 8 compatibility mode, any existing data space buffer pools or hyper pools are automatically converted to a primary buffer pool that is placed above the bar in the DBM1 address space. And basically any CPU regression you took in the first place, when you migrated to data space buffer pool or hyper pool, you now get back as a benefit. Now let's turn to slide 22. This chart here gives you more detail about long-term page fix. The clear assumption here, like with version 6 and version 7, is that once you're running in a 64-bit ESAME LPAR, DB2 should be fully backed by real storage. You must do this because otherwise, if there is significant page inactivity between auxiliary storage, which is DASD, and DB2, this will severely and adversely affect performance because the DB2 buffer pool uses an LRU algorithm for buffer pool or frame reclaim. And so basically, if you have significant overcommitment of the real storage and significant page inactivity, there will be a double I.O. on each buffer pool miss. There'll be an I.O. to move the page from auxiliary into real memory, and then the real I.O. to bring the data from disk into memory. So what I'm doing on this chart here is advertising here the command to actually alter a buffer pool to turn on page fix. This will make the change go pending, and you'll actually have to go through buffer pool reallocation to actually turn on this function. Normally, this will mean that the long-term page fix will be turned on at the next recycle of DB2, although theoretically it's possible to do this by, first of all, setting the VP size to 0 and then setting the VP size back to the original value. But it is clearly impossible to do this on buffer pool 0, where the catalog and directory are, but it may be possible on some of the other buffer pools. The performance benefit is inversely proportional to the buffer pool hit ratio. If you have a buffer pool with 100% hit ratio, there will be zero benefit from this improvement. But this would be very useful long-term page fix for buffer pool for a very small buffer pool, which do lots of sequential I.O. And at the bottom of this chart here is a repetition of the formula for calculating the relative I.O. intensity. And the higher the I.O. intensity, the greater the value. Now let's turn to slide 23. Many of you are attracted to go to DB2 version 8 because of the advantage of 64-bit virtual memory and the ability to generate significant virtual storage constraint relief. What I want to do now is set your expectations on what you may be able to achieve and discuss with you a technique that you can use to estimate ahead of time what you're likely to get in terms of benefit on version 8. What I'm doing here on slide 23 is providing you yet again a reminder of the 64-bit virtual memory map. What you see here is that significant fixed storage areas have been moved above the bar, such as buffer pools, buffer pool control blocks, and all the way down that list to IRLM locks. What you also see is that remaining below the bar is most of the thread storage, the local dynamic statement cache, and some elements or components of the EDM and the RID pools. The thing to bear in mind here is that thread storage and local dynamic statement storage below the bar has actually increased because these areas got fatter or wider because of 64-bit pointers, because we actually have to support Unicode and long names. So there's a profit and loss account here in terms of those areas that moved above the bar to generate headroom, and that needs to offset the increase in thread storage and the increase in the local dynamic statement cache. Now let's turn to slide 24. Here is some detail here about which elements of thread storage remain below the 2 GB bar. And the three main areas are agent local, both system and non-system, get mained stack storage, and a local dynamic statement cache. And you must expect some regression in these storage areas. Some rough estimates are provided on the second half of slide 24. For system threads, we're talking about basically 40%, and system threads are things like deferred write engines, prefetch engines, cast-out engines. We're typically talking about 30 to 40% for static SQL, 50 to 100% for dynamic SQL, and so on down this chart. One of the most interesting areas to talk about is the EDM pool. In version 8, the EDM pool has been split into three different areas. Two of those areas are new, and they're moved above the bar. One of those areas contains the database descriptors, and the other area contains the global statement cache, where prepared statements are actually moved above the bar. What remains below the bar is the old EDM pool, and specifically what's contained in there is the cursor tables, the package tables, the skeleton package tables, and the skeleton cursor tables. Before doing any rebind activity on version 8, the EDM pool below the bar is still roughly the same size in version 8 relative to version 7, even though the database descriptors and the prepared statements have moved above the bar. The reason why the EDM pool is still the same size is because these components in version 8 that remain below the bar have actually become larger in size. But I need to tell you and warn you that when you actually go through a mass rebind at some point or incrementally proceed through rebind of all plans and packages in version 8, I've seen fairly significant increases in the size of the EDM objects below the bar and also SPT01. And in some cases, I've seen between a 30 to 50% increase in the EDM pool and SPT01. Now let's turn to slide 25. This chart here is a chart which shows a series of unnamed customers who are known to me. They're part of my social circle. What is shown on the y-axis is megabytes. In other words, the megabyte below the 2 GB bar and above the 16 MB line in the DBM1 address space. And on the x-axis here is the individual customers. Now, I need to make it very clear here. What I'm doing here is comparing virtual 7 actuals to version 8 estimates. What each of these bars here actually shows an individual customer. The top of the yellow is the size of the user region, the size of the maximum theoretical extended private region available to DB2 and other system tasks like CICS. What you'll notice here is that the size of the available private is highly variable, and much depends on the size of the extended common areas and the demand for common area storage. What you can see if you look at customer number 3, going left to right, this customer only has an extended private area of 1190 megabytes. Almost half the address space is already gone, and the reason for this is because they're a big IMS user, and IMS, for performance reasons, takes big advantage of extended common areas. The top of the red here is the storage usage on version 7, and the blue, the top of the blue, is the storage usage on version 8. Customer number 1 here is actually a customer who was not using any data space buffer pools, and as you can see here, they got the most dramatic virtual storage constraint relief in version 8, and this is projected. In actual fact, this customer already migrated to version 8, and these estimates were almost completely spot on, and this is one very happy customer. If you look at the next 6 customers, you can see that they get somewhere between 20, 30, 40, 50% virtual storage constraint relief. Some of these customers are well known to me, some of them have actually migrated to version 8 already, and these estimates have proved to be very accurate. So as you can see, for most customers here, there's dramatic, or at least significant, virtual storage constraint relief in version 8. Now, there's something special here about these 2 customers on the right-hand side. These are very special situations. These are customers who've been on what I call the JC diet plan. They've been following my advice on version 6 and version 7 very closely. They've fully exploited data space buffer pools. And what you can see here, because you can't see any red, that's because the red is hiding behind the blue. These customers actually could go negative on migrating to version 8. And in both cases, remedial action was already taken to identify some opportunities and to generate virtual storage constraint relief. So those customers who have a huge number of threads make very significant benefit of the local dynamic statement cache and are using 100% data space buffer pools. If you've got all 3 things in combination together, there is a possibility that you may fall into this special category. The main thing is to be forewarned in advance. Let's turn to slide 26. In slide 26 there, we have a spreadsheet model, which you can use yourselves. If you haven't used it already, use it after this webcast as a way of projecting your storage usage on version 8. In column 1 is a description of each of the storage areas that you can see in the IFC ID 225 data in the statistics trace, and what the values are in column 2 from the version 7 statistics trace. The values in column 3 is the version 8 estimation. And what you're able to do here using the notes on the right-hand side is estimate what percentage virtual storage constraint relief you can get in version 8 from the version 7 statistics trace. Now let's turn to slide 27. What I want to leave you here is with a summary about the value of 64-bit virtual storage. DVM1 64-bit virtual storage exploitation in version 8 is extremely valuable and will generate valuable additional relief for many customers, but it will not eliminate the problem. Many customers, through either organic growth or through mergers and acquisitions, will continue to be constrained by virtual storage below the 2 gigabyte bar in the DVM1 address space. But for many customers, there will be generous virtual storage constraint relief, or at least significant virtual storage constraint relief, and they can exploit this additional headroom to exploit more active threads and DBATs. But going forward, installations will have to continue to capacity plan for, monitor and tune, and optimize storage below the 2 gigabyte bar inside the DBM1 address space. Now let's turn to slide 28. What I'd like to do now is provide some expectations and guidance on real storage usage. As I said earlier, important subsystems like DB2 should not be paging to auxiliary storage. The recommendation is to keep page in rates relatively low, near zero, and to monitor this using RMF Monitor 3. All customers, I think, recognize that the backing rate of real memory behind virtual for 31-bit storage must be complete backing rate, where virtual equals real. But there has been a bit of a misconception that the backing rate is low for pages above the 2 gigabyte bar, and this is completely wrong. Virtual storage usage above the bar does not come free of charge. You actually need to have a full backing rate. So basically, through the combination of virtual storage below the bar and above the bar, our increase in real storage in version 8 is definitely to be expected, as control blocks are bigger for 64-bit storage, and there's increases in stack storage, system threads, and also user threads, and most significantly, the management of storage above the 2 gigabyte bar. And what I've observed in a number of customers is a significant growth in real storage, 50, 60, 70, even 100%. So I'd like to discuss this some more. Can we now turn to slide 29? In slide 29, I want to strongly recommend the following maintenance as critical service for version 8. Much of this became available in second quarter 2006. Most of this maintenance is actually for DB2, but there's also a ZOS APAR as well. And what I've provided you on this chart here is a recommendation or description as well of what these APARs do. And basically what these APARs are all about is either about reducing real storage consumption or about more accurate reporting of the storage, or in fact making sure that when DB2 tells ZOS to discard storage, that ZOS will actually do it. So please apply this critical service. Now let's turn to slide 30 and talk about how we could estimate in advance the real storage requirement. This method assumes the critical maintenance on this previous slide has been applied. What you want to do initially is subtract out the fixed pools, buffer pools, and EDM pools, and then we need to plan on the assumption that virtual equals real, and factoring increases in the areas below the bar, such as stack storage increasing by 100% and so on. And then what we want to do is identify how many active threads and DBATs we're going to do and allow 1 megabyte per active thread or DBAT above the bar. Although this is pessimistic, it does enable you to get an outline estimate. Add back in the fixed areas of the buffer pools and EDM pools, and if you compare the total value against version 7, you will get a reasonable idea and outlook as to the increase in real storage in version 8. And basically, in many cases, I'm seeing between plus 10 to plus 30 to 40% increase in real memory. Those customers having large buffer pools will tend to see a much lower percentage, whereas those customers running relatively small pre-production systems, where the buffer pools tend to be small, will see a higher increase. Now let's turn to slide 31. Now what I want to do is talk about query performance. There have been some significant performance improvements in version 8 and optimizer changes to take more advantage of index access. For example, if you had rogue applications before which weren't using the best coding practices, whether there is a difference between the data type and precision of your host variables versus, for example, the SQL data columns, these predicates would now be stage 1 and indexable. Now, if this is a static SQL, you'd have to go through a rebind to take advantage. This function of having more stage 1 indexable predicates is available in compatibility mode as well as in new function mode. So if you've got static SQL, a rebind of static SQL plans and packages in version 8 compatibility mode will deliver this benefit. Many customers following a rebind of all plans and packages in version 8 have reported either equivalent or significant performance improvements. But in some cases, there has been access path regression. Some of it has been caused by defects in DB2 where there's now maintenance available, but sometimes it's been caused by not having complete statistics or even stale statistics available. So one recommendation when running your RunStats utility executions is to use the option key card to collect additional statistics. One thing I strongly recommend that you do is to download from the web the latest versions of Visual Explain and Statistics Advisor and to install these functions in your environment and get familiar with using them. Many customers who've had access path selection problems have used the version 8 Statistics Advisor to identify missing non-uniform distribution statistics which ones to collect, and then plan a RunStats execution to execute and collect these statistics. And following then rebinds of plans and packages, they've then actually taken benefit. What I'd now like to do is talk about a technique called the dummy collection method, which is aimed at static SQL plans and packages. And the intent here is to provide a very easy, implicit way of falling back to the previous access path. Now let's turn to slide 32. This technique was explained and described by some of my colleagues, Gene Fu and Terry Purcell, in a recent iDoG Systems Journal article. So what you see here is the current situation, and it's a very simple example just for illustration purposes, is you have a plan called A with a package B, which is bound into a collection called V7col. At some point prior to version 8, this package B was bound and added to a collection called V7col. And the plan A was bound with a key PK list that pointed to a collection called V7col. And basically at runtime, when the package was requested for the first time, DB2 would look in version 7col through an index match and try and identify the right package, version of the package to be used based on the consistency token. Now the idea of this technique basically is to introduce a new collection in version 8 called V8col and to do a bind copy operation to take the version 7 package and bind it into a different collection, and then to rebind the plan, modifying the PK list. So now the PK list specifies V8 call followed by V7 call. What we have here now is implicit package versioning. Program B will now use the new package version B that's in V8 call instead of using the old package version B in the old collection V7 call. Now hopefully in most cases you will get equal or equivalent performance. However, if unfortunately you may run into some performance problems that cannot be quickly resolved because of bad access path selection, what you can do is actually free the version 8 version of that package from the collection called V8 call, and what will then happen is that through the PK list search, the application will fall back to using the old version of package B in the V7 call. This allows you to have a very nice safety net or reserve parachute of being able to rebind plans and packages, taking advantage of new access paths and hopefully better runtime performance, but in the event of running into trouble, to be able to have an orderly fallback, an easy fallback, to the previous access path and the previous package. Now let's turn to slide 33. What I'd like to now do is move on and talk about the major performance opportunities in version 8. First of all, on the top half of slide 33, I've identified those items where we can talk about really dramatic performance improvements. So for example, use of materialized query tables for data warehousing and business intelligence workloads. If you've got rogue applications which have a mismatch, an unlike data type and length, between the host variables and the SQL column data types, and these predicates would now be stage 1 and indexable. If you're a customer who's already collecting non-uniform distribution statistics on non-indexed columns using a user program called dstats, this function is now provided within runstats. And by executing this function inside runstats, we get dramatic CPU reduction. There are also many other access path selection improvements. For example, we now support not padded index in version 8. So once you get to version 8 new function mode, you can alter some of those indexes which have got varchar columns to make them not padded. And for the first time, we now have the opportunity of index-only access. On the second half of the chart are items that can improve performance or have the potential to improve performance by 2 to 5 times. And I'd like to draw your attention to some low-hanging fruit here, which is the multi-row fetch and multi-row insert. These syntax is now available in version 8 new function mode. And with a relatively small row set size of somewhere between 10 and 100 rows, you can actually demonstrate and get very clear CPU reductions. And the sweet spot is somewhere between 10 and 100 rows. And I've also listed the other functions there for early exploitation. Let's now turn to slide 34. What I'd also like to do here is share some thought leadership. Many of you would like to improve your service levels, but also many of you as well would like to get additional virtual storage constraint relief. And two of the big ticket items in version 8 for exploitation are 1, ESA compression, and also supersizing your buffer pools. Many of you had to go on an ESA compression diet in version 7 in order to get virtual storage constraint relief. The big thing in version 8 is those ESA compression dictionaries completely go above the bar. So you now have the opportunity in version 8, even in compatibility mode, starting in compatibility mode, to start exploiting more and more usage of ESA compression, not just to get reduced disk space or faster sequential scans, but also to get a better buffer pool hit ratio. And if you can do that, you can reduce synchronous I.O., reduce the ZB2 activity time, otherwise known as the class 2 elapsed time, and basically you need fewer threads to maintain the same throughput, or you can get much higher throughput with the same number of threads. And the same thing applies to actually supersizing the buffer pools. Once you get to version 8, the buffer pools are moved above the 2 GB bar, and provided you have the large real memory to exploit, to back it and fully exploit it, then again you've got the benefit here of reducing synchronous I.O., reducing the DB2 activity time, and requiring fewer threads to maintain the same throughput. Now let's turn to slide 35. What I'm going to do on this slide and the follow-on slide here is advertise some of the performance features. One of the key things I think to go after very early in the new function mode is look for opportunity to exploit multi-row SQL syntax. This avoids the repetitive CPU overhead of a round trip across the SQL application interface. Two clear opportunities here are multi-row insert and multi-row fetch. The benefit of multi-row insert is not just CPU. There also could be dramatic improvements in elapsed time for client-server traffic. Let me give you some snapshots here, sound bites to illustrate this. I've seen up to a 29% reduction in CPU for a small row set size of 10 rows. I've seen a dramatic reduction in network traffic for client-server applications because individual insert operations do not qualify for DRDA block fetch. So exploitation of the multi-row insert syntax can dramatically reduce the number of message send receive pairs for the rows. And I've actually seen up to an 8 times reduction in elapsed time performance for client-server applications. If we talk about multi-row fetch syntax, I've seen up to a 33% reduction in CPU for a row set size of 10 rows. And again, I'd like to stress that even in version 8 compatibility mode, if you're already a big user of DRDA and exploiting DRDA block fetch in version 7, that you get automatic implicit multi-row fetch between the DDF and the DBM1 address space in version 8 for read-only result sets and also for ambiguous cursor result sets provided the current data parameter on the bind is set to no. Let's turn now to slide 36. The other big things about version 8 and any mode of version 8 is this is the target level of DB2 to get to exploit the ZIP technology. The ability for certain types of workload to be eligible and to be offloaded to a ZIP engine, which basically is aimed at improving resource optimization and lowering the total cost of ownership. There are benefits here in terms of reduced software costs and also in terms of reduced hardware costs. We're targeting specifically here certain types of workloads, which I will describe in a minute. Exploitation of the ZIPs is completely application transparent. In order just to estimate the actual offload for the various types of work, all one has to do is to migrate to any level of version 8 and to have the prerequisite maintenance that came out in June this year. And then you'll be able to exploit the extensions to the existing and also take advantage of new instrumentation to get accurate estimates of the amount of workload that is eligible for the ZIP offload. If you actually want to install ZIPs and exploit them, then you'll have to be on System Z9 hardware on the C9101 processor to take advantage of ZIPs, and also have to be on ZOS 1.6 or later. But just to be able to estimate, to get an accurate estimate of the offload, all you need to do is be on DB2 version 8 and any mode thereof, and apply the maintenance. And repeat once again, provided you've got the requisite operating system and hardware, again, you can exploit ZIPs on any mode of version 8. If you now turn to slide 37, this slide, at a very high level, describes the three types of workload that are eligible for ZIP offload. The first offload is DRDA workload over TCP/IP. The obvious candidates here are the classic ERP CRM application serving workloads like SAP, Siebel, and PeopleSoft. But it also applies to many new web-based e-transaction processing applications. Many of you are running your e-business application server tier outboard from ZOS on Linux, Unix, and Windows. And again, if you're running that over DRDA, over TCP/IP, we're targeting here a 55% offload of the individual SQL requests. Also, many of you are using stored procedures. Now, stored procedures run in TCB mode. So at first sight, you would think there'll be 0% eligible for offload when you're using stored procedures and user-defined functions. However, even here, certain aspects of stored procedure processing, such as the original call and the processing of the result set, will also qualify for ZIP offload. And in some of our internal benchmarks here, we've seen 10 to 12% offload, even for a customer workload, which is making very heavy use of stored procedures and user-defined functions, which run in TCB mode. The second area of eligibility is data warehousing applications. With our original announcement, this was limited to parallel queries against our schemas. However, as part of our re-announcement in June, we actually changed this. Now, any parallel query, whether it's coming in through Star Schema, whether it comes through DRDA or not, will qualify for additional 80% offload after the first 100 milliseconds of Z9 CPU. So if these parallel queries were coming in over DRDA, they would get 55% offload for the first 100 milliseconds of CPU, and then an 80% offload for the CPU beyond 100 milliseconds of CPU. For those parallel queries not coming in over DRDA over TCP/IP, there would be 0% offload for the first 100 milliseconds of CPU, and then 80% offload for anything beyond the first 100 milliseconds of CPU. And the last area of exploitation is the DB2 for ZOS version 8 utilities. And basically, portions of the DB2 utilities related to index maintenance processing during load, reorg, and rebuild index processing are eligible for ZIP offload. And basically, the greater the proportion of the number of indexes on the table, the greater the amount of eligible workload to be offloaded. Let's now turn to slide 38. Now what I'm going to go and do is talk about some of the other items of exploitation in version 8 when you get to new function mode. One of the obvious ones here is online schema evolution, which is the next great step in continuous availability. You can think of this as a dynamic alter. In version 8, you have the ability, for example, to extend character columns, to change the column data types within a domain. By a domain, I mean numeric, character, and graphic. Everything is okay if it's referenced by a view. It's okay if it's indexed. However, one needs to be careful here about index availability. If you're making changes in the area of char, varchar, graphic, and vargraphic, you have immediate index availability. However, if you're actually adding columns or changing the scale and precision of numeric columns, this will place the index in rebuild pending status, and it's strongly recommended that you immediately rebuild the index to remove this status and to make this index eligible for basically both static and dynamic SQL. Any indexing rebuild pending will block dynamic SQL for deletes, updates, and inserts for non-unique indexes, and also query optimization. And finally, if you add a column to the end of the index, the index will immediately go into rebuild pending status, and again, it's strongly recommend that you rebuild the index as fast as possible. Now let's turn to slide 39. You also have the ability to add a partition at the end of the table space. Rotate the first to last partition. You've got the ability with reorg, share level none, to do automatic rebalancing of the rows across the partitions. We now have a really big change in the area of partition table space. We've now got a thing called table-based partitioning. We've got a clear divorce here between the concepts of partitioning and clustering. We no longer need a specific index for partitioning, and we can actually partition based on one column or column criteria and cluster by a different set of column criteria. And we also have the ability as well to change the clustering index. Let's turn to slide 40. On slide 40 here, I'm trying to give you an overview here of data partition secondary indexes. We use the term DPSI, data partition secondary index for short. This provides for more efficient utility processing, higher availability, streamlined, concurrent, partition-level operations. There's potential here for lower data sharing overhead and reduced impact for some types of queries, but one has to bear in mind that for certain types of queries that are not well qualified on the partitioning key, there may be a degradation on query performance. Things I'd like to stress here about data partition secondary indexes. These have proved to be ideal and fantastic for concurrent utility operations, or concurrent utility partition operations, and where we can almost get near perfect concurrency. You cannot use DPSIs for unique indexes, and it will compromise query performance if the queries are not qualified on the partitioning key. So there are three kinds of index now in version 8. The existing partitioning index, but it's now optional in version 8, and it may or may not be partitioned. We've got the new data partition secondary index, which is new in version 8, and also the old-style NIPSI, non-partitioned secondary index. If we now turn to slide 41, what we've also done in version 8 is we've relaxed the limit significantly on the number of partitions. Prior to version 8, the maximum number of partitions was only 254. We've now extended this limit up to 4,096. It applies to both table spaces and indexes, and any table space that's defined as large or with a DS size parameter can go beyond 254 parts. The maximum table size remains at 16 terabytes. You need to be aware that the instance number at the end of the dataset naming convention has been extended in order to be able to support up to 4,096 parts. What you can see here on this chart is that we use the characters A, B, C, D, and E in the first character of the instance number as a way of identifying the partitions and being able to go up to 4,096 datasets. At the bottom of this chart here is a couple of examples here that you're asked to basically how big the table space size would be and how many parts you could have depending on the page size and the DS size specification. So with a 4K page size and a DS size of 1 gigabyte, one can have up to 4,096 parts and a 4 terabyte maximum table size, whereas with a 4K page size and a DS size of 64 gigabytes, although we can only support 256 parts, we can now support a maximum table size of 16 terabytes. Now let's turn to slide 42. We've got some very interesting function that we've introduced now in version 8 that I'm going to describe on slide 42 and also slide 43. This is a way of providing a very efficient way of first of all being able to take a non-destructive backup of your complete system to prepare for point-in-time recovery. What do I mean by a non-destructive backup? I mean There's not even a single microsecond of an outage. So there are two new utilities in version 8, and the first one is the backup system utility. And this exploits the new copy pool technology, which is a new HSM construct, which is a named set of SMS storage groups. You have, in fact, two copy pools, one for your data and one for your logs. This function is only available for the first time in ZOS 1.5. There's also a new DFSMS construct called a copy target. And a copy target is a storage group that's reserved to be the target of a flash copy. So what the backup system utility does, it's a very simple syntax. It's a disk-to-disk copy, exploiting flash copy technology. It invokes HSM to take a flash copy of the respective database copy pool and optionally the log copy pool. This is done non-destructively in the background. There's no need to do a set log load suspend. The copies are actually registered in the bootstrap. Certain activities will be quiesced whilst the copy is being invoked, such as 32K page writes, dataset extends, etc., and pseudo-close. But it's much less disruptive than today's technique using a split mirror and the set log suspend and resume technique. We now turn to slide 43. The second half of the story here is the restore system utility. This gives you the ability to restore the complete system to any point in time. Basically, any point in time you wished you thought of. There's a very simple procedure to recover the system to an arbitrary point in time. There's a new type of conditional restart, which must mean you must put a record into the bootstrap of each system, each DB2 member, to truncate the logs at the desired log point. You then run the restore system and any one of the members of the group, and what the restore system utility will do is restore the database volumes from the appropriate copy pool backup. It will automatically handle objects created since the restore point, automatically handle log no events, delete any objects dropped since the restore point, and it will handle and covers both data sharing and non-data sharing. The progress is both checkpointed and also restartable. What you have here, it's a much more efficient and easier process for taking a non-disrupted backup and a much more easier and more efficient process for actually restoring the system to an arbitrary point in time following application failure or logical corruption caused by any means. And this will be of great benefit to many ERP and CRM customers. Now let's turn to slide 44. On the next set of slides, I'd like to advertise another function which has been introduced in version 8. It was introduced subsequent to the original announcement and which has proved to be very attractive for many customers. This is called automatic space management. This is a smart or autonomic function which slides the secondary allocation quantity size. It applies to DB2 managed page sets only, and the goal of this function is to be able to try and avoid VSAM maximum extent limit errors. The vision here basically is to allow a data set to reach maximum data set size before running out of extents. There are actually many ways of actually using this. There are in fact 3 or 4 rules involved with this. But the vision in the future, now if you want to, is basically to create an object without specifying any primary or secondary quantity and to allow DB2 to set the primary and secondary quantities automatically and allow that data set to scale to the theoretical maximum size before running out of extents. So in terms of these rules, if you ever do provide an explicit primary quantity, we will always honor it. If you specify a 0 secondary quantity, we will never allow the data set to extend. If you actually provide an explicit primary and secondary quantity, we'll always honor the primary. And provided you've got a new ZPALM set, we will always honor the secondary unless we determine through the secondary sliding scale that a higher secondary allocation is required. We will always honor the secondary. But once we determine a higher value from the slider secondary scale, we will override the secondary quantity provided. And the fourth option, of course, is to provide a primary and a secondary, but to leave the new ZPALM set to no, in which case we will always honor the primary and the secondary. Other changes in version 8 will be that the default primary quantity will be 1 cylinder for both non-lob table spaces and indexes and 10 cylinders for lob table spaces. If you want to use the full function here, then the way to do it for new page set is there's no need for any primary or secondary quantities. If you want to use this new function for existing data sets, you can issue an SQL alter for the existing objects to convert the primary and or secondary quantity to -1 Well, minus 1 is a special value indicating no primary or secondary quantity, and then schedule a reorg to implement. If we now turn to slides 45 and then 46, we'll see some examples of the sliding curve, sliding secondary scale. This assumes both the primary and the secondary quantity were left off, or the values were set to minus 1 followed by a reorg for existing data sets. What you see on slide 45 is first of all on the y-axis the extent size, and on the x-axis the extent number. And what you see here is a table mountain curve. It's what I call it, a table mountain curve. And what you see is that between extents 1 and extent 127, we gradually slide the secondary allocation. And basically at extent 127, the maximum extent size of 559 cylinders is reached for data sets whose theoretical maximum size is 32 gigabytes or 64 gigabytes. And then the secondary allocation size is flat for the remaining extents. There's two very good reasons behind this table mountain curve. Firstly, when the number of extents is small, we want to avoid penalizing really small data sets. And on the other end of the scale, the reason why it's flat for the second half of the scale is we want to avoid wasting, first of all, very large amounts of disk space for a very large last secondary extent, and also to avoid really large secondary extent sizes in themselves. If you turn to slide 46, you will see a similar scale for data sets whose maximum theoretical size is below 32 gigabytes, and what you'll see here is a similar table mountain curve, except in this case, the maximum extent size levels off at 127 cylinders. And let's now move on here and talk about some of the other benefits in version 8. On slide 47 is a list of the limitations that have been relaxed in version 8. I'll just pull a few of them out at random. We've already talked about the virtual storage. Let's now look at things like the table name sizes have increased from 18 to 128 characters. The number of parts has gone from 254 now up to 4,096. SQL statement length has increased from 32 kilobytes to 2 megabytes. Basic index key size has been expanded from 255 to 2,000. So basically we've increased these limits significantly in version 8. On slide 48 are some other changes. We've increased the number of active log pairs from 31 to 98. The maximum table size has been increased from 16 terabytes to 128 terabytes when you've got a partition table space with 32 kilobyte page size. On page 49 and subsequent slides, I'd like to advertise one of the key things in version 8. If you look back over versions 4, 5, 6, and 7, there were not that many SQL enhancements in those versions of DB2. But in version 8, there are more SQL enhancements in version 8 than the previous four versions put together. On slide 49 here are a list of the SQL enhancements in version 8 aimed at convergence with DB2 for LUW and enhanced portability from less powerful database platforms such as Oracle and SQL Server over to DB2. Now, on slides 50, 51, and 52, they're a bit of an eye test, but I'm just using them for illustration purposes. On slide 50, what we're doing is comparing DB2 for ZOS version 7 versus DB2 LUW 8.2. And there are three categories here. First of all, there's the ZOS exclusives. At the bottom is the LUW exclusives, and in the middle is the common SQL. And what you can see here is that there's very little exclusive on DB2 for ZOS. There's not that much that is common SQL across them, and there's a large number of unique SQL on DB2 for LUW. If you now turn to slide 51, you can see in DB2 version 8, there's an absolutely dramatic change. There are now some uniques on DB2 for ZOS. There's a big increase in the amount of common SQL, which illustrates what I was trying to tell you here, that we're trying to reach a conformance across the platform. And also, there are still some uniques on LUW, but there's a much smaller list of uniques. When you actually look closely at these unique SQL functions, those functions which are unique to DB2 for ZOS are related to OLTP applications, and those which are unique to LUW are biased towards data warehousing and business intelligence. And this reflects the majority of the user base. What you're going to see going forward is both these platforms crossing over and implementing all these respective SQL functions. We now turn to slide 52. This represents the story on version 9. Now what we're doing here is comparing version 9 of DB2 for ZOS versus DB2 LUW 8.2. The items in green here are the specific new SQL functions in version 9. And this continues the theme in version 8. Now you see a very large common subset of SQL across the two database platforms. In fact, I would say that we're nearly 95% more common SQL in here for typical EOLTP web-based transaction processing. Again, you see now a smaller number of uniques on DB2 LUW. They're still biased towards data warehousing and entity analytics. And on DB2 for ZOS, there are some uniques, but they're unique to OLTP. So going forward, now in version 9, version 10, and so on, what we're trying to do here is converge the two platforms in terms of the SQL APIs and the SQL functions. What I'd like to do is turn to slide 53, which is the final slide. What I've tried to do in this presentation today is to address some myths about DB2 version 8, to provide you some strong advice in places and general advice on how to upgrade to version 8 as quickly and as safely as possible, and in the second half of version 8, talk about the value proposition in version 8 in terms of improved performance and scalability, and to advertise and take advantage of some of the important availability features, and to remind you of the many SQL enhancements in version 8, which are aimed at application portability and enhanced conformance with the DB2 for LUW platform. I'd like to thank you for your participation so far, and now what I'd like to do is hand over to the coordinator so we can start the question and answer session. Thank you very much.